Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm going to continue to talk about how we create stories about ourselves, which I call our cover story. Stories which are part of the truth, maybe even in some cases most of the truth, but are almost never the whole truth about ourselves. I'm going to talk about how our cover story gets created and how hard it is to break a cover, that is, to discover that we are more than we thought we were, more than we were telling ourselves we were, more than we're pretending to be to others. And then I'm going to play an interview with Mary Anna Evans, a really interesting, complicated woman who makes a living both as a chemical engineer and as a writer of mystery stories and occasionally as a singer. There's a lovely story in there where she said that she and her husband used to play and perform, and they were glad when they made enough money to pay the babysitter. So she's a lovely interview, and I hope that what I'm talking about in terms of cover story is of real use to you. Hang on. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down
to The Lynn Show, which is today being brought to you by Asheville Hot Air Balloons in Asheville, North Carolina. Are you overwhelmed by all the unexpected things that are happening in our world? As a therapist, I know that one of the best ways to deal with difficult problems is sometimes just to take a break from them. And there is no better break than getting up above it all in a hot air balloon. Your burdens will lift, your perspective will change, and you'll feel liberated. It's fun, it's therapeutic, and it's cheaper than therapy. Tell them that you heard about Asheville Hot Air Balloons on The Lynn Show, and contact Asheville Hot Air Balloons either at their website, AshevilleHotAirBalloons.com, or call them at 828-667-9943. That's 828-667-9943. Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about discovering, becoming, demonstrating who you really are. As I say in pretty much every show, it's clear to me from my more than 30 years of practice as a psychotherapist and the many more years than that of living and observing that we human beings find ways to pretend. We pretend that we are some things, and then we pretend that we're not some things. As I have gotten older, I have noticed in myself the reluctance to continue to pretend that I am some things and pretend that I'm not some things. But that's conscious. I'm dyslexic, and I get a lot of things wrong. And for a lot of my life, I pretended that that wasn't so. I hid the fact as much as it was possible to hide, that I turned numbers around, that directions confused me, that my reading skills, although my comprehension was way off the charts, that I would miss things, and my grammar and technique were useless. So I pretended. I knew that I had trouble with this, but I thought that that meant something bad about myself, so I pretended. That's a conscious thing. It's something I knew about myself but didn't want to show because I thought it said something bad about me and people would decide something about me because of that. But that's not what I'm talking about here, although that, my God, is really important. If you know that about yourself, you might want to pay attention to it. Or you might just wait until you get old and you get tired of it, because as you get older, these things get harder and harder to hold on to. But what I'm talking about is the stuff of which we are unaware. Things about ourselves that, for reasons having all to do with our family of origin and the circumstances of our early life, we have hidden not only from everybody else, but from ourselves. The hidden stuff I call the undercover, for obvious reasons. We have kept it undercover. The stuff that we demonstrate, the stuff that we say, this is me, that's our cover. Now, you might think that a cover would only be good things. You know, we would only want to seem smart, healthy, interesting, clever, kind. But actually, our cover is what the circumstances of our early life suggested we had to be. So as I said last week, if you had parents who were basically insecure themselves and really got off on the dependence of their children, really felt, maybe for the first time in their own lives, the wonderful rush of being needed, such parents, without meaning to, can discourage independence, strength, in their children. Which is to say, they can encourage dependence. Now, this all takes place unconsciously. The parent says, no, don't do that. I'll do that for you. Or, no, you don't have, you can wait to do that. No, it's okay. Don't worry. No, it's all right. I know you didn't mean that. It's okay. Don't worry. I'll take care of that. And the child gets the idea, first, that it doesn't have to do, and second, that maybe it can't. And so even children who were perfectly capable begin to demonstrate incapacity, begin to demonstrate dependence. And of course, they believe for themselves that they are incapable. Ironically, in families like this, while the first child is quite often encouraged to be dependent, or in some families it's the female child, another child, perhaps the boy or the second child or the third one down, somebody has to take care. So that child gets assigned, you do it. That child gets a cover that says, I have to do it. I have to do everything because no one else will do anything. Everything depends on me. I'm the one. I can't let anything go. And so that child is in denial for or has undercover their capacity to not do, to depend. I wonder if any of these things sound familiar to you, either because they strike a chord inside of you or because you've seen it in other people. Anyway, the goal of this show is to point out that the you have always thought you were, and parenthetically, the everybody you always thought everybody else was, is probably only part of the story, and sometimes even a small part of the story. So for the last few weeks, I've been talking about cover story, the story we tell everybody else about ourselves and also that we've been telling ourselves about ourselves. Covers are stubborn and they're seductive. Your cover continues to affect you long after the reason you adopted it, whatever the circumstances of your original family, has stopped operating as a primary factor in your life. Even when you've had experiences that should have disproven your cover, this idea of who you are continues to determine what you believe is possible for you and what you think you can do and be in your life. That's because once you've successfully crafted your cover story and accepted that it is who you are and who you aren't, you forget that your cover is an invention. You made it up, or colluding with your family, you made it up. You come into adulthood believing your own cover story. For example, and this is a very common one, when overweight people who have fat or unattractive covers suddenly lose a great deal of weight, they often complain that they still feel fat and unattractive. This, of course, is their cover story, stubbornly clinging to the definition that protected them as a child. If the cover that protected you as a child disagrees with what you want to do as an adult, you can find yourself acting in very contradictory ways. The comfort of the known is seductive. Just the desire to avoid the unexpected can keep us from making changes that would enhance our life. You may think that that's nonsense, that it's not a good enough reason to keep from doing something that's hurting you. But the impulse to act in a predictable way so that everyone else will continue to act in a predictable way is a powerful reason to avoid change. Remember, you originally created your cover to guarantee your acceptance within your family. It was to assure the love and protection of your family that you disowned parts of yourselves, even important, even maybe necessary parts of yourself. The urge to stay covered can be overwhelming. You may despise the cover your childhood forced you to accept as truth, but as long as you believe that it is this cover that's keeping you loved and safe, you'll continue to act in the ways that perpetuate it. We all have to feel loved and safe. We have to maintain the balance of whatever family we're in. If the change you want to make, the thing you want to start doing, or the thing you want to stop doing, requires that you renounce your cover, and renouncing your cover threatens your safety, all your attempts to force yourself to change will fail. If you notice that you're maintaining your cover story and you wish you could abandon it, for now, try to accept that you're still receiving some benefit from acting as though it were the whole truth. This idea of loved and safe, this is not negotiable. We can't surrender our ability to be loved and safe. That's not negotiable. Our unconscious won't let that happen. It will continue to force us to do whatever it is that it believes we need in order to feel loved and safe. So what does that mean? It means that if in your family, when you stood up on your own two feet and said, "No, I'll do that," and your mommy's face crumpled, or your dad turned his back, or they punished you even, you got the message loud and clear that that behavior, that standing up for yourself, that taking responsibility was a complete no-no. You didn't do that. And if you did it, you risked either hurting, scaring, or angering a parent. Well, then the love that you needed and the safety you required were in jeopardy if you did that behavior. Your brain learns to associate standing up for yourself with the shock of the possibility of loss of love or safety. It drops a chemical in your bloodstream which says, don't do that. Danger, danger. And so whenever you get the impulse to assert yourself later in life, your unconscious flashes, the unseen, completely unseen by you, photograph of whatever it was, your mother's crumpled face, your father's back, the punishment, whatever it was. Your brain drops the uh-oh, danger, danger chemical in your bloodstream. All of this happens completely out of your awareness in the splittest second. And your impulse to assert yourself dies on the vine. So, you can see that if later in life it becomes essential, you believe it's essential, for you to assert yourself. Maybe you've been passed over over and over and over again in your job because your immediate supervisor doesn't like you for some reason. And what you need to do is go to that person's boss and make your case. You can see that every time you would want to do that, the flash in your brain, the dropping of the chemical, the recognition of that horrible feeling wherever you feel it, sinking in your stomach, the choking in your throat, the solar plexus, and you find the words won't come, you can't do it, or you just forget. Or maybe you're in relationship with somebody who's not nice to you, and it's bad for you, and you know it's bad for you. We all have heard the story of abused women who stand for it, and sometimes die for it. Well, they cannot do it differently if their brain is dropping the chemical that says standing up for yourself is too dangerous, don't do it. So, how do we change something like this? Well, I'm going to be talking about undercover in the weeks to come. The undercover is the other quality that you have, the capacity to stand up for yourself, the one you were demonstrating when you said, I'll do it, when you were two. You still have that, but it's undercover. And so I'm going to be talking about the undercover, how we do that, what the process of putting qualities undercover is, and then how you can uncover, that is, have access to those qualities which you need, because we all need all of ourselves. It's not enough just to be our cover story. However good our particular cover story is, whatever we're keeping undercover, it, first of all, we probably need it, and second of all, it takes energy. Even though you're not aware, it to keep that part of yourself down. So that's energy that's stolen from the you could be, the things you could do. So I'll be talking more about that and how you can uncover. What's the process for uncovering? But in the meanwhile, the most important step towards discovering what if it's your cover story and uncovering your undercover is awareness. Awareness is the most powerful tool that you have, and it doesn't take much of anything. So, just to use the example of, the inability to assert yourself. I don't know what's a word for that. Well, people could call it shyness or timidity or anxiety or kindness. Sometimes people call that kindness. Oh, I just don't put myself forward. It's not nice. Anyway, every time you notice that you are acting out of that impulse, just notice it. Oh, that's me being kind and nice. Oh, that's me just not putting myself forward. Oh, that's me standing in the background when maybe it would be better if I came forward. Oh, that's me accepting unacceptable behavior. And this is the most important thing. If you could see me, you would know that I am doing this in neon. Non-judgmental awareness. Not, damn, why did I do that? Or, God, when am I going to stop doing that? Or what's the matter with me? I always do it. None of that. You see, if you do that, then your unconscious thinks, oh, well, she just beats herself up, or he just beats himself up, or they just don't want to hear that because they make themselves unhappy when they recognize that, and soon enough it will stop letting you see awareness. Whereas if you congratulate yourself, oh, gosh, look at that. That's the third time this hour that I let somebody get away with something that I know they shouldn't be getting away with, because that's my cover story. I just let people have their way. Good for me. I never let any of these get by. I see all of them. When you do that, then your unconscious says, well, he or she or they really want to see this. This is a good thing. And you will begin to notice everywhere that you have this particular cover activity. I will be talking more about what you do when you have a bag of these awarenesses. But right now, if you are interested in discovering yourself, if you believe me that there's more to you than just who you have been, who you have thought of yourself as, how you have acted in the world, if you are curious, then the most important thing you can do, the only important thing you can do at this time, is non-judgmental awareness of whenever you find yourself acting out of that cover place. Now, I know I've beaten this up, but I also know that this is really hard stuff to remember. And we're always at the mercy of the neural firings of our brain that drop the chemicals in our bloodstream that say, don't do that. So I'm just going to keep repeating this because I know how hard it is to hold on to. But now I'm going to tell you about the next thing that I do in my show. The first part of the show is what I've just been doing, which is talking about what gets between us and the changes we want to make in our lives. The second part of the show, I interview people who make their living or their life with their art. And in this show, I am interviewing a woman named Mary Anna Evans. She's a mystery writer, and if you've been listening, you know that I've been doing mystery Perhaps that's not the correct way to say it. I've been airing interviews with mystery writers for the last few weeks as a result of having attended the Florida Mystery Writers Convention. Mary Anna is the first and only woman that I interviewed. She's really interesting. As you've heard, if you've been listening, a lot of the writers say creative people do a lot of things. And they have. I've interviewed lawyers and cops and chemical engineers. Oh, wrong. Mary Anna is the chemical engineer. And mommy, and also singer. And last week you heard from Don Bruns, who's also a guitar player and performer. So Mary Anna has a very interesting story. And her character is really interesting. Oh, did I say that the reason that I interview these people who make their living or their life with their art is because they, in my view, at least in that area of their life, actually are who they are? And this is because in this culture, it's so hard to be an artist that you pretty much have to fight for it. It has to be something you cannot deny. It has to be integral to you. And Mary Anna is someone who has fought for it in her way. So now I'm going to tell you how you can get in touch with me. If anything I said sparked something you want to talk about, you have any questions, if you want to tell me about your story, if you've recognized your cover story, you're interested in learning more about psychotherapy on the telephone, you want to listen to an old show of mine, you can go up on my website, thelynshow.com. That's THELYNNE, don't leave the E out, SHOW, that's one word, .com. You can click on email me, or you can click on the podcast and find all the old shows, or you can click on the book, or the CD, or you can read whatever it is I've got up there. So now I'm going to play a public service announcement and a short musical interlude, which is out of my CD called I Won't Go With a Whimper. And then I'm going to play my interview with Mary Anna Evans.
Do you worry about how much someone else drinks? Do you feel that if the drinker cared about you, he or she would stop drinking to please you? Do you secretly try to smell the drinker's breath? Are you afraid to upset someone because it might set off a drinking bout? Do you have money problems because of someone else's drinking? Do you ever ride in a car with a driver who has been drinking? We know it's not easy dealing with a loved one who drinks too much, but there's help and hope. Al-Anon family groups are for anyone whose life has been affected by someone else's drinking. You'll meet others who share your feelings and your frustrations. Remember, before you can help a problem drinker, you need to help yourself first. For a meeting near you, call 1-888-4-ALANON. That's 1-888-425-2666. Online, visit www.alanonfamilygroups.org. A message from Al-Anon Family Groups.
I can work the whole damn day, way into the night. Look like I don't need to play. I make out all right. And although I can fool you with my grown-up woman style, behind the woman there's a child.
So I am here with Mary Anna Evans. We've been talking about our names and how special they are, and it didn't occur to me to ask you when we were talking about it just a minute ago, but do you know, I mean, is this your real name?
It's my real name, and there is a story.
Yes, would you?
It. Yes, my parents both lost their mothers at very early ages. My mother lost her mother at 2. Her mother was 26 and died of pneumonia, because 26-year-old women did die of pneumonia back in 1939.
Yeah, right.
It was just when antibiotics were coming in, and there were people rushing to Mobile trying to get her antibiotics. She didn't make it. So, you know, obviously that marked my mother. My father lost his mother at 3 of tuberculosis, which killed 39-year-old women in 1937. But doesn't kill young women now. My mother's mother's name was Mary Alice, and my father's mother's name was Annabelle, and I was born to have this name. There, you know, I'm sure there was no question of what they would name me. So, and I love my name. I think it's pretty.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and it brings the generations down. It brings all the pathos and the love.
And the reverence for the family and the loss. Because
yes.
I didn't have any grandmothers. You know?
No, they didn't have mothers.
Exactly, and I have pictures of them, and they were both brunettes with fair skin and dark eyes, and I just feel just like a little bit of them still walks around.
Well,
this is very odd, but my father was orphaned at 4, mm-hmm. and I'm named for his mother. So, mm-hmm. how ironic.
Yes, it is. It is. So, names are very special.
Yes, I think they are. Mm-hmm. I think they are, and I do think that we identify with them, and they identify us in some important ways. And so I wonder, I mean, this is way off any topic we might have thought to talk about, but mm-hmm. has that whole, the mythology of that informed you in any way, informed your life in any way? Do you know?
I don't know so much. I know that having the lack of a female family line is an interesting thing.
Yes.
And so I have sort of just an image of what they must have been like. But I have two daughters, and I have a son. And in its sense of names, I think names are important, and I like names with a pretty romantic sound. So my children's names are not uncommon. They're quite common, but they're pretty to me. And Amanda and Michael and Rachel. And
oh,
I just
beautiful.
Like the way they sound and the way they look on the page. And that's just a writer's way. And I can't imagine any of them with a different name.
Yes. Their names are their own.
That's right. So clearly they could have had different names because I could have given them different names. But that's who they are. And as a writer, you know, talking about what we're talking about, I have to name my characters in such a way that suits who they are and what I need them to do in the story.
Yes.
And I like naming the characters.
I need to tell you, one of the things I do on my show mm-hmm. is I do a series called Anatomy of an Artist, mm-hmm. and I interview people who make their living or their life with their art.
Okay.
And I'm really interested in what you were just talking about how you name your characters. It's not a casual thing for you.
No.
No, it's very meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get to that, I ask everybody the same question, and I'd like to ask it of you.
Okay.
How did you find this? How did it find you?
Writing?
Yes.
That's interesting. My education is in engineering.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's not an artist's education, although I've come to think there's art in everything, and a beautifully solved problem is a work of art.
I have come to define art in a very broad way, and maybe mostly having to do with passion.
Mm-hmm. And I identify with that. I feel like there's art in everything, probably everything everybody does, and maybe the difference is that an artist recognizes it. So I love to cook. It's creative.
Mm-hmm.
I love to make my home. It's creative. I know I love to garden. I like to cook with food I gardened, and I like to have relationships with people in my life, and I feel like there's passion in all those things.
Yes, I'm sure.
And I think maybe the job of an artist is to communicate that to people who feel that, but it's not as obvious to them, or that they don't recognize why these things are important.
You know, you're making me think of something I haven't thought of in a long time. Do you know who Rollo May is?
I've heard the name, but I don't know.
Rollo May is a psychologist, I think he's a psychiatrist anyway. He's also an artist
mm-hmm.
and has written a number of books on psychotherapy and art, and in a really amazing book, whose name I have now blocked, he says the difference between neurotics and artists.
Oh, good, I want to hear this. I don't want to be neurotic.
Is that both neurotics and artists feel it when the culture is shifting, when there's underlying angst, when there's global shifts, and the neurotics are incapacitated by it, and the artists make something with it.
That really resonates.
Isn't that lovely?
It is lovely. And I'm also a musician. I'm a serious amateur musician, but I'll always be or semi-professional. Occasionally I get paid, but my ex-husband and I had a band for a number of years, and our measure of success was whether we made enough money to pay the babysitter. So
I just want to tell you that my ex-husband and I did too. And we would have been happy
paying the babysitter was the benchmark. You know? So you asked how I came to writing. I think writing is the art that I had the raw materials to be able to be professional at, in that I, you know, I am a very verbal person. I was a very early reader. I've read all my life. I communicate very well at speaking also. And it just came together as something that that I don't have the barrier of the process. You know, it would be very hard for me to communicate with visual art because I would never be happy with what I made. And I'm always slightly dissatisfied with my musical output, but I can say what I want to say when I sit down at the computer. So I think art is about communication, so that's just my communication.
Yeah, you feel that it's the clearest.
Yes.
Right?
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Great. So how did you start writing?
I was speaking, after my first book came out, I spoke in my hometown to a group of retirees, and someone asked me that question. So I'm sitting, there's a room of 50 people, and they asked me the question, and two hands in the audience go up because they want to answer it. One of them is my mother. One of them is my fourth grade teacher. And they raised their hand to say, she's always been a writer.
Wow.
So now, I wasn't one of those kids that went to my room and journaled, or, you know, I really did not write seriously on my own until I started thinking about writing for eventual publication. But I always really seized on my classroom work that required writing, and it was recognized by my teachers as being well done, and I enjoyed those, and they just prepared me for the day when I felt like I had a story to tell.
And so did that just one day happen? You said, gee, that's an interesting story, why don't I write a book?
Well, it wasn't quite like that. I did take creative writing in high school and wrote a story, but I was very busy, you know, doing other things. And I'm a practical person, so it occurred to me that I might need to eventually support myself when I chose a major. And I was good at math, and I enjoyed, and it was an interesting creative thing to me. So I majored in chemical engineering, and I'm glad I did, because there have now been two occasions in my life when I found myself single and with children to support. So engineering has served me well, and my father always said no education is ever wasted. But when I got to graduate school, I found that it had been 6 months since I'd even written a complete sentence. You know, I'd scrawled Greek letters and numbers all over countless pages of graph paper, but I hadn't communicated anything in English, and I felt like the right side of my brain was shriveling up. And so I actually audited a short story writing class because it didn't cost any more than taking a full load, and I didn't have to do the homework.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody else took tests and wrote two stories and did, you know, all these projects, and I wrote one good solid story and lucked out because there's a very well-known writer, Ellen Douglas was the instructor at that time, and she was quite prominent. So I still have the A+ from Ellen Douglas, and I put it aside, but I just didn't see myself making a living at it. So during my 20s, I wrote at night, you know, and when I had two children in diapers and a full-time job, I wrote haiku. So I wrote whatever my life let me write. And I did publish a few of the haiku, but basically I wrote and was rejected for many years. And in my 30s, I was pregnant with my third child, and because of my health history, I knew I would be on bed rest for that entire pregnancy. And I thought I will never be able to say I didn't have a chance to write a full-length book.
Mm-hmm.
So I even still did some engineering during that pregnancy. I consulted 10 or 15 hours a week. And,
yeah, of course you did.
And wrote half a book. Because, you know, there's 24 hours in a day, and I don't watch daytime TV. So, you know, I had a lot. And I wrote half a book, and it took me 4 years to finish it, because after that I had a baby, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it got me an agent, but not a sale. It got me close to a sale, but we didn't sell that book. But after that, I had an agent that could tell me what she thought she could sell. So she gave me enough guidance to write the book I wanted to write. And at that point, I decided to not try to second-guess the market, and I just wanted to write the book I wanted to write. And if it required a 50-cent word to say what I wanted to say, I would do that. And if it required a sentence as long as my arm to say what I wanted to say, I would do that. And I wrote the book, and we did sell it. And astonishingly enough, with that vocabulary and those sentence structures, my books are being read in schools.
Wow.
I had no idea I was writing for adults. I still write for adults, but the schools have recognized some. Well, one thing is you can teach math and science from my books. Because I don't write about math and science, but I'm really persnickety that the laws of physics operate properly in my books. And so if a cell phone is dropped out of the pocket of someone falling to their death and the person dies but the cell phone lives, I feel like I need to make it plausible why that happened.
Wow.
And so
do you explain it?
In an artistic way.
Can you give me an example?
I would. Well, in this case, the body fell into a copse of trees, and obviously the young man died, but the
cell phone was first of all built to withstand shock, and it landed on flexible pine branches, and there's a beautiful passage that I think is quite poetic that follows the cell phone to the ground.
The descent? It's the cell phone? The descent of the cell phone?
And when the person finds it and turns it on, sees it still works, he has just a moment of a pang of, you know, why the boy didn't make it. Why did the cell phone make it? And so it's a very brief moment, less than a paragraph, but you can teach a physics lesson from that paragraph.
Yes.
And so people are doing that. And I'm actually working with a professor of young adult literature, and we're going to write a book on math literacy, on how to use books that kids like to read
to teach
them things they don't think they're interested in.
Yeah, that's great.
It's fun.
Yeah, I like the work. It's great. So it keeps growing. Then,
yeah, I just follow my nose.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that's so important to say. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much talk about, you know, how you have to do it, mm-hmm. what's the right way, what's the way that will work, whatever. And I think that, well, clearly that limits the creative process.
Sure.
And then it undermines the passion because, you know.
That's right. And because there's not a, if there were a formula, people would pick up on it when they read the book, you know. And I know I've been on the other side of the table. I know that people are frustrated that they can't sell their work, and I kind of feel like they think you're holding out on them. If you just tell them the formula or give them the secret handshake, that it would, and it's not there, they have to find their own story. You know? And then
I've had people ask me, how do you write a song?
Yeah.
I don't know.
You have to have something to say. And then you have to figure out how
actually,
to say
the truth
it.
Is I write from title.
I do a lot of times with my
do
books.
You?
Yeah, I have to have a title before I can really seriously start.
Me too. And I'll have an idea, but I can't write the thing until it's like it encapsulates it for me somehow.
Right. And that just shows the different styles, because I have very fine writer friends who don't always know the book's title.
Until the end. Right.
Or they're happy to send it in and let the editor name it.
Oh, my God.
I would be nuts. I have. It's like a child. I have to know its name. And my books have one-word titles, just like children do.
That's very funny.
I write about an archaeologist, so the first one is called Artifacts. The second one is called Relics. And at this point, my son was a sarcastic teenager, and he said, Mom, if you call the first one Artifacts, second one Relics, what are you going to call the third one, Trash? So one day I'm going to write Trash.
Trash.
For Michael.
Well, my God. So I like to ask people to talk about, well, first of all, anything I haven't asked you that you want to respond to.
Sure.
And also what it's like for you to have a life that really, it's really an artistic life.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Do you mind? Can you talk about that at all?
No. I really am happy to be able to live my life on my own terms. It's not easy. You don't make a living most of the time as a writer. I still do, you know, a few hours of engineering consulting a week. Because, you know, you got to put food on the table.
Right. Pay the babysitter.
That's right. And I do other things. I'm working on the math literacy work, and, you know, hopefully we'll sell that book. And I get paid for speaking gigs. I do, I'm putting on a writer's conference in Gainesville, Florida at the end of July for people that would like to learn how to do this. I love to teach. I like communicating with people about finding their own art. So the beautiful thing is I do all these different things, and I love them all.
Yeah.
I just get crazy sometimes figuring out what needs me the most today.
I guess I know that one.
Yeah.
What's up?
That's right. But it's so much, it suits me so much better than going into the same desk every day. Even when I worked at an engineering job, I was a consultant, so I still worked on different projects all the time.
You know, it's this, everybody doesn't have this, and actually I interviewed a number of people here who are still working full-time jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But not everybody values their freedom to choose what they want to do when they want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what I mean?
I do, yeah.
And people like that, like you and ironically me, have to find a way to survive in this culture, which is so designed. The conventional wisdom is that you find a niche somewhere and you do it right. over and over, whether you like it or not. And do you know what I mean?
I do. And also, there's also, and it's related, in that if you want to become very educated, you have to choose a specialty and become very good at it. And I did go as far as getting a master's degree and was urged to go on for a PhD in chemical engineering. And I just didn't, I loved what I was doing. I didn't want to X off everything, all the other possibilities in life. And so I didn't want to do that. So I went, my first job out of school was teaching community college, which is a very creative thing to do. And I actually, I think in one of my books, I describe my character as trying to choose a dissertation topic. She has at least focused on archaeology, but she can't choose what branch she wants to focus on. And she said, you know, really, she didn't understand why there wasn't a PhD in general studies, that she would have been born to. And that's, I think, if I could have gotten a PhD in general studies, I would have been very happy.
Happy.
But that's just not what our culture considers highly educated.
No. We're more and more specialized, and if you're not specialized, you're not serious.
Exactly.
And so then there are people like you and me who do what other people would think of as too many things.
Right. When it does work, though, it's our culture needs it. Even when I was specializing, my work was on the branch between chemistry and physics. I mean, the border between. And I find that I just tend to always be on those borderlines. And there's exciting things to be done when you...
In the crack.
And so that's always where I'm going to be. And we need those people. It's just that if there should be a way to find those people and train them to do it, because we need them to.
See, I think that, I don't know exactly how to say this. I think a lot of people who would do that are dissuaded from doing that.
Right. They're and somebody's well-meaning saying, you know, you really need to pick something.
Right, exactly. And you wouldn't have to train people to do that. That's, I guess, suppose the point I'm trying to make is if you just encourage them, then they would do it.
Exactly.
You know.
But it wouldn't hurt to help people that are not naturally disposed in that way learn to do it some and appreciate it.
No, that wouldn't hurt.
No, and so that's what I find doing with my math literacy work. You know, I'm going out. I'm a writer. I'm teaching teachers who have specialized in math. Learn how to bring books and words into
so in an interesting way you're demonstrating it right?
So maybe there aren't so many people like me, but maybe I can help people who are very good at teaching math come up with a tool that will help them reach kids that think they don't like math.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I think it's even larger than that, and that is that you demonstrate that a person who can be good at math can also be a creative writer.
Right.
You're just living it, so you're essentially presenting it as an option.
Right.
Which I think is maybe the most important thing you do.
Just go out and talk to people.
Just to be. Yeah. You know, just to be. To say this is an option. Mm-hmm. Being this kind of person is an option. And being this kind of person is a joyful option.
Yeah.
You know?
It is.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. You just have to find something you love to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I agree entirely. So, is there anything I didn't ask you?
Not so much. Not on our topic. You know,
is there anything you want to talk about?
Well, we could just mention the books.
Please
do. A couple of them. I write about an archaeologist, and she's a person that straddles boundaries in that she's biracial. She grew up in the South. Mm-hmm. She's always felt like, actually, she turns out to be triracial by the end of the first book. And she's always felt a little bit like an outsider. And she gives me a platform to look at American culture, Southeastern culture, American history from a lens that's not like anybody else's. Her experience is not like anybody else. And, of course, nobody's experience is like anybody else's, but she's a visual. She has as a visual marker of being an individual, completely individual. So her name is Fei Longchamp. She begins my books as a black market archaeologist, but she goes straight in the second book. So the first book is Artifacts, where we meet her and learn about all these things. She goes back to school in relics. And effigies, she travels to Mississippi to the Choctaw Nation, and we learn an awful lot about that part of American history where we removed the native peoples and sent them away, and the fallout from that. I'm from Mississippi, and it took me three books to do my home state because I was afraid I could never go home again. But they liked it. It was well received, and it received some awards. My fourth book
takes Faye back to her roots and dealing with the death of a very dear friend and father figure. And that fourth book is different from the others. It's the newest one. It's called Findings. The third one was Effigies. I think I didn't mention that. Findings is, I had written the whole book thinking it was like the other books. They're mysteries, and I think of mysteries as the literature of justice. I take the beginning of the book and I set the world askew, and then at the
end... You put it back together again.
Back together, the person is still dead. Now, you know, you can't fix the past, but justice is done, and people need that, I think, when they read a book. They need to feel like justice can be done. I thought I was doing that again in book four, and I wrote the last chapter and realized I was writing a book about love, that there's no character in that book that is not touched for good or ill by romantic love. And that was a real revelation to me, that you could not know what you were writing.
Yes.
So that's the current book. It's out now. And my next book will be out next month in July. And it's called Floodgates. And it's set in New Orleans.
Oh, dear.
And it deals with old New Orleans history with the frame story of Katrina, and that there's a body uncovered that people presume is one of the last drowning victims to be found. And my archaeologists can tell by the condition of the crime scene that that's not what has happened here. But in unraveling that case, I get to take a look at some of the events of that week from an engineer's point of view. And it's the first book where I feature engineering at all. I sold the book because my editor said, oh, I don't want you to do New Orleans. New Orleans has been done. Do something different. Do Baton Rouge. And I said, no, I want to do New Orleans. I have a personal history there. I have family there. And I do not believe New Orleans has been done by an engineer who might have something to say about the levee failures. And she said, oh, okay, go ahead and do it. But I hate the title. But I get 100 pages in, and she says, now I see what you're doing, and I like the title, Carry On. So it's called Floodgates. And all my books, I have historical characters that are like a Greek chorus from the past, telling a story that may be related to the current mystery and may just be a Greek chorus, kind of echoes of the past. And so in this book, my voices from the past are engineers, because it occurred to me that we had to have New Orleans where it is. It's history required that there be a city there. And it's in the best place it could possibly be, but it's still a pretty crummy place to put, you know, a million people. And it occurred to me that it would not be there without the engineers that built the dikes and the levees and the canals and invented the drainage machines that didn't exist before we had to have that city. So I have a very wonderful man from the 1800s that I created who is one of these heroic engineers. And so I had a fabulous time writing that book. I enjoyed my research trip to New Orleans immensely. And it's got a starred review from Booklist, so I'm anxiously awaiting its arrival next month.
That's wonderful. It's wonderful, and I want to tell you, I have always said, I read mysteries because justice is done. Mm-hmm. I know that's why I read them.
Right, yeah. You know? People think they read them for the mayhem and the gore, which I don't
read them. No. I skip it anyway.
I'm not interested in reading it, writing it, whatever.
No.
I'm interested in the human psychology of it all. Why do people do it, and how do people react, and how do you put the pieces
back
together?
Well, I'm a psychotherapist.
Oh, exactly. I'm an amateur.
So I'm going to run right out.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Marianna, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this.
So, Marianna Evans, mystery writer, amateur psychologist, mummy, cook, chemical engineer, singer, songwriter, multitasking at its best. I hope that you enjoyed that interview and also that you're interested in reading her work. I certainly am, as you heard. And I also hope that what I was talking about at the beginning of the show about our cover stories and how they protect us, how we are trained, encouraged, cajoled, coerced into creating a story about ourselves which is only part of the truth. And creating that story so that we can feel loved and safe. And then how we manage to hide that from everybody, including ourselves, so that we grow up believing that we are part of who we are. And as I said in the beginning, the best way to begin to change that is with awareness. And I will be talking more about awareness and how you change long-held beliefs about yourself so that you can do your life differently in the weeks to come. And in future shows, I will be talking about undercover, your undercover qualities, those that you had to hide from everybody, including yourself, so that you could continue to feel loved and safe. Before I end this show, I want to do what I always do at the end of these shows, and that is to tout, announce the value of Josh Hackney, who, as I have often said, makes this show possible. At least he makes the quality of the show as good as it can possibly be. And then when I run into things I don't understand or have forgotten how to do, there is Josh at my back, making it right. And so, of course, if you need anybody for any kind of IT problem, electronics problem, recording, Josh Hackney is the guy. And you can reach him in the same way that you can reach me, by going up on thelinshow.com, click on email me, say I need Josh, and I will get him for you. And as always, I hope that you heard something in this show that you can use, something that you either didn't know, or that you knew but you forgot, or that you didn't know you knew, but now know you have always known, something that interested, amused, titillated, annoyed you, whatever, just something that brings you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang.
I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang, so...